A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's the Fight In.
Interesting, mate. Yeah.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Extra Inch. My name is Windy, and I'm joined this time by, once again, my tactics guy, Nathan A. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
Hi, mate.
And we have another very special guest. We've got Tiago, and oh my god, I apologise in advance, Estevao. Hello, Tiago.
Hi. That was good.
Was that good? Okay, I passed the test. That's the first test pass. That's good news. Before I introduce Tiago properly, as you may have heard in our previous episodes, we've got ourselves a sponsor for the next couple of months, and it's a sponsor chosen specifically as it could be of interest to our listeners. So we're working with OneFootball, which is a football app. It's available on the App Store and Google Play, and they've currently got an article about whether Christian Eriksen and Dele will be rested against Crystal Palace this weekend. At the risk of this discussion becoming very quickly dated, let's have a quick chat about those two players and what they offer us, and how we can cover their skill sets now that we know a little bit more about how the likes of Lucas, Lamela and Harry Winks look this season. Nathan, have you got any thoughts about how we can manage when they're not in the side?
So managing without Eriksen has been a huge, huge issue for us, basically the entire time we've had him. Fortunately, he's a cyborg and he plays most games. I think that finally this season, missing Eriksen for a game here or a game there is not the total catastrophe that it has been in the past. I think the fact that Lamela is playing so well at the moment, I know we're going to talk about him later, and the general depth of quality we have in that area, and also Dele stepping up creatively, sort of in that department for him to sort of balance the task a little more. Obviously missing both of them at the same time, that's still going to be a bit of an ask, and we have missed them a couple of times already this season, and we've struggled, but yeah, because we've got some more depth in attacking midfield and especially in creativity generally, it's not the end of the world that it once was.
And I guess the heartening thing was that against Wolves we managed without them and still got through the game, which we'll talk about shortly. But let's talk about Tiago. Tiago, if you don't know him, is a performance analyst for Goalpoint Pro. He's also an under-15 coach and a podcaster. Tiago, can you tell us a bit about yourself, your background, about Goalpoint and how you got into this? And also, fascinatingly, about your role with Braga this season.
Hey, so some of the listeners may or may not know me from Twitter for being on the internet too much. But I used to work as an analyst, as just writing, much like Nathan does often. I work as a performance analyst at Goalpoint, which is a consultancy company, pretty much. We work with data, but I do the work that I previously used to do in terms of my regular articles. So I still work with video and mix it with data and to give a proper interpretation of the game, of what I think of the game. And so we work with clubs in terms of recruitment, in terms of match analysis, and Braga this season is the club that we're most involved in, or at least publicly speaking. And me and the people that work with me, we work with them in terms of recruitment. Let that be finding targets or evaluating names that come at us. And then we work together in terms of match analysis, let that be their own team's match analysis, like post-game, and also opposition analysis, mainly. I do a lot of work in that. So, yeah, that's been our role this season. It's been going well. It's a partnership that's been going pretty well. We have a strong connection with the people there, and we feel like they understand the benefits of our presence and that they value it, and that's great.
Are we able to talk about how many people are involved in this setup?
I mean,
so
if
how,
you want
like,
to.
As in how many would the club use, for example?
So, as in terms of a company, we're obviously a Portuguese company that doesn't have the reach that certain other companies of the same realm do, right? So we're obviously smaller. We have a couple of people, me and a couple of people working in terms of the actual final part of analysis and more specific recruitment and match analysis stuff. And then we have people on the background working on things like data and visuals and things like that that are kind of the basis for what we do, really. So, yeah, it's not a huge group of people, but it's pretty well divided in terms of what everyone does and what everyone's role is.
And is this pretty much, from your perspective, the norm now in terms of football clubs outsourcing this kind of analysis to companies like Goalpoint, who do the work for them and then feed back in?
It depends, really. I think for the scenario we have here, it ends up being ideal. But like if you're looking at a Premier League scenario, you're going to be looking at teams that do have in-house data analysts and multiple of them and a huge team of them that are awesome at what they do and that they can focus on the team like 24/7 and work with the scouting department and all of that. But here and in many other places that are not as developed as the Premier League in terms of how they look at the game, these types of companies definitely benefit the situation because we can work with teams that have a more traditional scouting department and we can like complement what they do, which is pretty much what we do at Braga. And I would tell you that most teams here don't do this kind of work. I think we're definitely on the forefront in terms of our league, at least. And I think that shows also. But yeah, I think these types of companies or these types of services definitely end up benefiting teams that can't afford to have an in-house data analyst or multiple of them or can't afford or can't understand the benefits of just out of the blue hiring someone to work with data when they don't even have a data provider, let's say, you know. So this is definitely a middle step that can benefit a lot of coaching staffs, a lot of teams. And yeah, you got to contextualize it, having in account that like we're not looking at a Premier League club that do have all of this and more within their house, per se, within their team. But for this context, I think it's probably the ideal middle step for now in terms of modernizing how teams work.
I think it's so fascinating, and Braga are performing really well this year. They're joint top in the league. Maybe there's something in that. Maybe there's, you know, obviously you're probably biased, so you would say there definitely is something in it. But if other clubs aren't achieving the same thing and aren't using data in the same way, then perhaps it shows that there are advantages and gains to be made there. Just from the perspective of someone who might want to get involved in this kind of career, could you give a little bit of information about your background and how you ended up getting into this?
So, okay. I've always been into football, much like all of us, I think. I eventually started writing about football and started writing about football specifically in English because I'm comfortable with the language and thought I could get myself like more noticed for some reason. It kind of worked, I guess, so I can't complain too much, but you know. And the way I used to write initially was just kind of my interpretation of the game, so probably bad, I guess, if I had to take a stab at it. But eventually, from being around social media and Twitter and all that, I discovered analytics, I discovered people that work on this stuff, and then I tried to quote-unquote specialize myself in it. I tried to look into it more, tried working more and more with it, figured out that not many people here are doing anything with analytics work, and it was a lot of personal learning. I don't know if that's the expression, but you know, you get what I'm saying. I didn't take many courses with it. I'm finishing university in communication sciences, so it doesn't have anything to do with football, just so nothing on that front. I've if anything, my connection to football was more like coaching related. Like when I was 16, I was coaching already, like coaching young kids and stuff. So my connection was a lot more in terms of practicing and less so in terms of coming from a data background or from a mathematics background, because I don't come from that at all. And then within data, after getting myself comfortable within the topic, I started taking some, like, smaller courses in the subject and going to every sort of meeting I could go and stuff like that. But I can't tell you that I'm coming from a data background or from I took this or that in university, because that didn't happen. And if anything, then I've noticed that within data analysis or performance analysis or whatever you want to call it, I can perform a role of like intermediary between looking at data and more traditional people that look just at video and trying to explain the benefits of one to the other, because I come from the iTest, quote unquote, background per se. You know, I don't come from a pure numbers-based world. Like, I don't create metrics, but I can use them properly to analyze and I can explain to you the benefits of them, even if you're someone that's been in the game for a long time and that has a very specific traditional way of looking at things, you know? So that's kind of been my frame of work always, really.
That's so fascinating. It sounds to me as though, I feel like you're being quite modest, but it sounds as though you've got like a really good all-round skill set which benefits the role you're performing, which is, you know, you're not a trained data analyst, but you've become a data analyst through practice. You are a trained coach, so you understand the basics of coaching and the tactical elements of football, but then you're also a fan of football, and you've watched football for many years, so you have an understanding of the game. So, and clearly you're a good communicator. We know that because we've heard you on podcasts, we've read your writing. So you kind of have this kind of mixed skill set, which makes you it's a perfect storm.
I think without trying to. Okay, I think you complimented me too much there, but either way, I do think that having a broad skill set is beneficial, and I tried to go for that to a certain extent, because again, like, I can do most things in terms of analysis. I write, I all that, and I can pass down information, which is key, really. Pass down information with well enough, or quite well, I'd say. And I think in a world where you're getting more and more people involved that come from a pure numbers data background that don't have as much involvement within the game, I do think you need people that to perform like this middle term role of like figuring out how to translate one thing from to the other and vice versa, and to connect everyone on board. I think like there's benefits to most very specific skill sets, but being able to kind of jump around and try to fit everyone into this string of connectivity per se, I think that's very important.
That's amazing. And I think it's no accident that we've got you on around the time that Spurs played Wolves, because of course Wolves have a Portuguese coach and you're Portuguese, and we want to speak to you about Nuno Espirito Santo. But let's talk a little bit first about the match itself, and Nathan, I'll get your thoughts on the match first. It was a fascinating match for so many reasons, but tactically, a really interesting battle, and there was a lot of focus on both sets of fullbacks. What did you make of the game generally, Nath?
I feel like so I didn't watch the game at the time. I sort of tried to half watch it very drunk on my phone and came away with no memory of it other than the two penalties. So I sort of went back to watch it, having sort of looked at what people were saying on Twitter. And what people were saying on Twitter was that Spurs were really good in the first half and then really bad in the second half. What happened? And I don't really agree with that premise, because I felt that both teams were quite poor throughout. And as you pointed out, the main focus, the main benefit for Spurs is that we did a really good job of pinning their wing backs for most of the game, which is something I wrote about beforehand. The importance of doing that, because they really focus their possession through their wing backs. Everything they do is about stretching the opposition as wide as possible all the time with the two wing backs. So yeah, I felt we did a good job at sort of hitting the main tactical point with Wolves. But I also felt that generally we were very poor in midfield. That's not surprising because Moussa Dembélé went off sort of down within the first minute, and we had a midfield two of Winks and Sissoko, which, you know, both those players have their benefits and everything, but as a midfield pairing, you're obviously going to have issues there. I'm not entirely sure why or how Wolves managed to sort of switch things in sort of the final few, or final 20 minutes or so.
I've got an idea.
Okay, so go on. How did they enable their wing-backs at the end there?
Morgan Gibbs-White. Literally bringing on Gibbs-White. Don't get me wrong, Wolves have a terrific midfield. Neves and Moutinho are both really great players. Good all-rounders, I would say. They kind of do everything well. But when they brought on Gibbs-White, they suddenly had an expansive, creative passer who was willing to take more risks. And he did that, and his passing enabled the forwards to make runs which pushed our defence back, which created space in turn for their fullbacks to push forward. And that was, in my opinion, the turning point of the game. And I think Gibbs-White is a fantastic, fantastic prospect. He's 18. He's part of the 2000 group. He's part of the England under-17 squad that was so successful. Spurs have a couple of players in that squad too. So TJ Ayoma and Tashan Oakley-Booth are part of that age group as well. So it's kind of seen as a golden group in a way. But Gibbs-White is a really impressive young player. Interested to hear your thoughts on Winks and Sissoko there, because I thought defensively they both had a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be typical of me to absolve Harry Winks of responsibility and say it's because he was playing alongside Sissoko. I do actually think there's a bit of that, because Sissoko just constantly vacated the central midfield area. But neither of them produced a single tackle in the 90 minutes. Neither of them produced a single interception. There wasn't a lot going on in terms of combativeness or even just holding position and soaking pressure up. Winks was better on the ball, clearly. He is better on the ball, but neither came out with much credit, I thought, from that game. Spurs were at their best when they were countering, and we were ruthless when we had our chances, that's for sure. And there was definitely some positive points. But Wolves did expose some of our weaknesses in that last 25 minutes. So let's talk a little about that. Thiago, presumably you saw the game. What did you make of Juan Foyth, our centre-back, making his Premier League debut?
I actually didn't know much about Foyth, but I was impressed, especially on the ball. I think he had a couple of moments. I was texting Nathan about this the other day. Like, he had like one vertical pass that burns like one or two lines that I was really impressed about. And he's definitely someone I'm curious to look into. I can tell you right now that I'm not, unlike Nico, who was on the pod last week, I'm not overly impressed by Davinson Sanchez. And so I'm definitely curious to see if I like Foyth more. About the game in general, while you're talking about the lack of defensive actions from the midfield too, not only did Winks and Sissoko not produce like a single tackle, Winks was dribbled 5 times, which is remarkable, even against Wolves, who have pretty much an entire cavalry of dribblers. That's problematic in a central area. And I thought it was really interesting that after Youngmin Son came in, Lucas Moura stayed central and Lamela stayed wide. I thought Lamela would move into the center and have Lucas on one channel and Son on the other, but it ended up being Lucas on like supporting Kane. I think it has its negatives, but mostly like to break down Pat defenses, his dribbles even through short spaces are really beneficial through the center, and he connected the game well enough to be beneficial, I think. I just thought that was interesting because I wasn't expecting it.
And Lamela was really effective in that wide role. I mean, his goal was really quite special, actually. It's the kind of goal that doesn't look anything, and then when you watch it back a couple of times, you realise how much he has to do there to score that goal. It was really impressive, and he is truly back to his creative best now. He's putting in regular, consistent performances where he is basically the creative hub of the team, and he's making things happen with his first-time passes and his reverse passes. Nathan, how important is Lamela for Spurs right now?
Well, as we sort of touched on earlier with Eriksen and Delhi missing games, he's huge. I do think that this was his best game so far this season, because, like I said before, I thought we were really poor. I thought we struggled to deal with Wolves' pressure. We didn't make the ball arrive in the final third well. But fortunately, when we did get it there, Lamela's his movement, his pace of play, his passing carried us to a couple of goals, really.
Yeah, I totally agree. He without him, I don't think we'd have won this match, quite frankly. I'm interested to talk about Foyth and the penalties and those situations, but I'm going to talk about them in context, because something quite interesting happened after the match. Every week, or every Spurs game, a couple of our journalists who cover Spurs, Ben Pearce and Alistair Gold, the two best journalists. Yeah, I went there, Dan. I went there. They produce match ratings post-game. They produce articles which rate all the players, and they give a paragraph to explain their ratings. And they both got savaged on Twitter for their ratings in this game. They gave Trippier 5 and 6, respectively. So Ben 5, Alistair 6. And they gave Wan Foyt 4 and 5, respectively. I wanted to talk about what you thought generally about the value that match ratings offer to fans, and whether you like marking players out of 10. And if so, how would you base your ratings? Nathan, let's start with you.
I'm not a big fan of the the post-match rating. I think there's a lot of issues. The first, that it is hard to keep track of 11 players over 90 minutes, and also you're writing your on the whistle report, and you're writing your five things you may have missed, and you're writing your whatever else. So I think it's asking an awful lot of journalists. I think most, I want to be careful what I'm saying here because I don't want to be too rude. I think most traditional journalists are not equipped to assess players that well. Obviously, they can assess it on the level of a fan who can do what I'm doing, not do what I'm failing to do now, which is express their words well. But I think that's all of these issues are sort of considered and continued through anyway, because it's when Ben and Alistair say, well, Foyth gave away two penalties, therefore he had a 4 out of 10 game, and then the fan base sort of get back at them, is when all of the content gets a lot of shares, and there's lots of engagement and lots of clicks. So that's coming from the editors, and it's maybe even coming from high from that, in that it's not about being correct, it's about sort of galvanizing Twitter. So essentially that is my problem with them, and I don't place that blame at all on Alistair or Ben, because like I said, they're asked to give these ratings and they've got an awful lot going on while they're trying to write their match report. So I don't blame them at all. I just like ratings generally.
And just to make it clear that the point of this discussion isn't to dig out Ben or Alistair, because those guys do amazing work covering Spurs. Absolutely, mate. We're so lucky to have them covering, and I was being ironic earlier, we're lucky to have them and Dan Kilpatrick all covering Spurs, because they generally all write such with such balance and dexterity. Actually, they all write really well about Spurs, and they don't shy away from being negative when it's needed, as can be seen from these ratings. Tiago, have you got anything to add on what Nathan said there? Would you generally agree?
Yeah, I mean, I think Nathan was a bit harsh on traditional journalists, but he's somewhat right. But I also think that even for us, that I can, even for me, that I consider myself someone that can evaluate a player, it's really rough to ask me like post-match ratings if I'm just using my eyes, right? I think it's just too much. It's 22 players or 11 players. Did they just give notes to the Spurs players, or did they? Or
just
is it
the Spurs? Yeah, okay. Just the Spurs players.
So it's 11 players. It's still a lot of people. It's a lot of actions. You're often only looking at the ball instead of looking at the entire game. You value whatever you value, and whatever next journalist is going to value, whatever his life and values brought him as beneficial for a game. So it's very inconsistent, and I don't see much of a point in it, especially if it's coming from a like from a journalist instead of a machine, quote unquote, that collects stats. And even when the case is player ratings from stats, like stat-based, like stat accumulation player ratings, you need to, before using it, like be for whatever you want, you need to figure out what kind of stats are going into the player ratings, what is being valued, what is being devalued. And so even those, although more precise, because, well, yeah, although more precise, they're definitely not without their flaws. And you need to figure out, much like in any other aggregator of stats per se, you need to figure out what is being valued, what kind of stats are in the mix, and then you kind of only use it as an initial ranking of sorts and not for much else, not to give final conclusions per se. Like, sure. We at Goalpoint do have like a player rating, like post game player rating from stats, and like I find it more beneficial compared to other websites that do have similar things, simply because we use more stats. The way it's contextualized, I think it makes more sense to the way I see the game. It doesn't count on things like if someone scores, the entire team doesn't go up, because I don't think that makes much sense. Things like that are corrected in ours, but I still don't use it as any final anything. I just can look through it in terms of having a ranking of sorts, but then to give any sort of comment or final thought, I need to look into the games and actually look into their stats and not just their rating, right? So it doesn't benefit much, but it's good for social media, much like Nathan said. Sorry.
It creates discussion, if nothing else, and in this case it certainly did, because I think the general feeling was that Juan Foyth had 65 really positive minutes, and then within that last 25 he made two naive challenges. I personally felt the second penalty was really soft. I mean, he's running alongside, he has a little stumble, he puts an arm across. Whether that arm is enough to take someone to the ground, I don't know. He shouldn't have done it, of course. He was naive, like I said, but I think had that been Jan Vertonghen easing someone out of possession, I don't think the referee would have given it. And the first one, I mean, Trippier tries to nutmeg a guy first, and I just want to put my head in my hands at that moment. Mm-hmm. Not only tried to nutmeg a guy, but nutmeg him going back towards his own goal, so he's then going to have to clear on his left foot. None of it made any sense. But then Foyth, in a kind of attempt to make up for that error, rashly goes to make a challenge when actually Jimenez is going away from goal, and that challenge doesn't need to be made. So, yeah, two errors from Foyth, and they kind of they undermined what was otherwise a really positive performance. And like you mentioned, Thiago, he played a couple of nice balls out from the back. One in particular that you mentioned, I think it was the one that led to Harry Kane's curling shot, where he broke through two lines.
It's one to Lucas, 65th minute. I remember, right, because I had to tell Nathan, because he was asking me the minutes. It's one to Lucas. He's like in a central position already in the final third. It's a good pass. If we can find a GIF of it, we'll publish it somewhere.
That's awesome. And also he's really really strong at dribbling the ball out. He reminds me an awful lot of John Stones of 3-4 years ago. And I think with a player like that, you have to persist with them and carry on just accepting occasional errors, because there's so much upside to having a defensive player that can actually play football. And Foyth was great. I'm not going to say much more about Trippier, because we speak about Trippier constantly on here, and it's all been said already. Let's instead speak about Wolves' manager and their style of play. Thiago, tell us what you know about Nuno Espirito Santo.
So Nuno is a very interesting character, especially now. He was here. He spent pretty much his entire career as a player here, but as just a backup goalkeeper. I don't really remember him on the pitch. Then he turned coach. He did well at Riwav, which is a upper mid-table team here that tends to go to Europe. He brought them to the Europa League. He went to Valencia through the influence of his agent, George Mensch, but did well there, even though maybe he wouldn't have gotten the opportunity if he didn't have that agent. But he did well enough there. He came back, came to Porto, was a bit more questionable here, but ended up leaving after a season for being second, because that's what happens when you're fighting for the title here. And eventually went to Wolves, and there he became a lot more interesting from a tactical standpoint. He kind of always adapted to a certain extent to the players he had, and while he always wanted to have the ball, always wanted to build out of the back, and he always made a lot of usage of high fullbacks, and he made sure a lot of the focus of his team's play was on his fullbacks. I still think he completely reinvented himself and the way he approached the game in the Championship and in England. And he started using this three-back formation he never used before. And he started being a lot more interesting in the way that he adapts. But I also think that this system, it lends itself towards that a lot more. I think with the 3-4-3, you can do a lot of things. You have a lot of players in beneficial spacings already, and you can adapt to your opponent well enough. But I think it became a lot more interesting there. He revamped his look as well. I'm not sure that counts. He also has a collection of really, really good players that he's taking the most out of, right? And not only he's doing a really good job of mixing players that we know are really, really solid. Mostly, most of the Portuguese players, or almost all the Portuguese players that he has there, were players that we all thought were really, really good and were almost too good for the Championship. But he also picked up players like Connor Cody. Is it Connor? I should have asked. like Cody to become a centre back and to become a really essential part of the piece and team captain, and be keen the way that he play out of the back and keen the way that he sweeps between the two other centre backs. Even Bennett still being a starter. Like Gibbs White now, I think, from what I've seen this week, and if this weekend it speaks of his level of quality, then he has a really big future. And the fact that they really only have Neves and Moutinho as almost their only two midfield options, they only have Saiz beyond them, means that Nuno has a lot of trust in Gibbs White, and he's definitely going to give him minutes. So I think he's doing a lot of interesting work in a lot of fronts. I think he's using recruitment well. There's obviously a connection to Jorge Mendes there, but while in theory as a club, I'm not sure you want to be connected to an agent this much, but in terms of results, I can't tell you it's working poorly, because it's not, right? So it's an odd balance, but it's one that they're doing well enough, I think.
And despite losing their last three matches, they're still 11th in the table. That's really impressive for a newly promoted team. Nathan, what are your thoughts on Wolves generally? Are you impressed with them?
I am. I was hoping that they would sort of have the ball a little more, as sort of they did in the Championship. But then obviously if you're one of the top teams, you can have most of the ball, and it is the Championship. And they've really adapted to a sort of a more defensive game plan, which is more about pressing and more about counter-attacks, which is still good to see, and it's still very nice at all, and there's still a lot of really exciting passes, especially from Neves. I do think that their game plan against us was pretty poor. I think they pressed too high, and I think they stretched themselves out way too much, and that if they had sat a little deeper, which they normally do, into their sort of their deep medium block, which is a phrase I keep using on this podcast recently, and just sort of messed up the area there, then they'd probably have shut us out. But there you go. Yes, they're really good to watch. Well, they're pretty good to watch this season.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Okay, let's talk a little bit now about the PSV game, because I feel in a similar way, it was another game of fullbacks. And Spurs had a lot of work to do early in this game. So we conceded after a minute, and that happens, you know, early goals do happen and it changes the game plan. But it made life really difficult for Spurs, who suddenly got a bit desperate. But overall, I think it was a really strong performance. And another on another day, some of those early shots would have gone in. We'd have been, maybe, let's say, 2-1 up at half-time, and we'd have gone on to win 4-1. But as it turned out, we required Harry Kane to save us in the last minute of the game with a hugely deflected header. Nathan, what did you think of the performance against PSV? Were you as impressed as I was?
Yes and no. I think that there were issues within it. I don't normally write about mentality. I prefer to stick to the tangibles. But I feel that it was unavoidable with this game. When I wrote my preview for the Palace game for 12, I talked a lot about the PSV game because I feel that there was a lot of nuance to the mental aspect of this game, in that I think that panic was setting in at the end of both halves of the game. I think that our game plan started to break down. I think we started to lose patience. I think we started to go a little more direct than we wanted to. So in a way, there was sort of a mental shortcoming in that we got, you know, a bit, air quotes, Spursy, but also we stuck with it. We didn't completely collapse. We were stretched and we struggled, but we kept at it and we got the win in the end. So I think that it's a really interesting game from a mental perspective. Again, something I don't normally talk about, but unavoidable with this one because it's so hard. It's so hard to concede in the first minute from a corner, an XG of 0.05 or something. And also, you know, the larger context of our Champions League campaign so far, which has been torturous this season, in that we've played so well. We've played so well in every game, really, and not got the results. So I was impressed with our mentality, basically.
And I think we need to talk a little about Harry Winks, because having slated him for his performance against Wolves, and obviously the knock-on effect of the game against Wolves meant that we were depleted in central midfield again. He essentially played in the middle by himself, as far as I could make out. He completed the most passes. This is as per Spurs Statman's tweet on the night. He completed the most passes, 80 out of 88. He created the most chances, 7. He made the most ball recoveries, 13. He had the joint most tackles, 1, 4 out of 4. And made the second most attacking third passes, 29. I was there, and it's not just about the things that Winks does on the ball, it's about what he does off the ball. And don't get me wrong, we were caught out a number of times on the counter, and had PSV been a better team, they might have scored more than just their one goal. But Winks was really the leading light for me in this performance. Everything started with Winks, who's incredibly creative. He played some really good long balls, which is something we haven't seen quite so much of him since he came back from injury. I was super impressed with Winks. Thiago, what do you make of Harry Winks generally, and did you notice this performance from him?
Yeah, I mentioned Nathan on a post about Winks' numbers, and Nathan's reaction was, yeah, against a team that stops playing midfield like about halfway through or something. So Nathan, who's Winks' biggest fan, wasn't as impressed as we were, apparently. But regardless, I think it was really good. I was impressed by him. I think that I said this before the game, but I think that having Eriksen beside him is more beneficial than having Sissoko beside him. It leaves him less exposed somehow. While there were still issues, but you know, you can't have it all, and there's literally no other option at this point, right? Other than what, Skip maybe. But I'm not quite sure of Skip's characteristics, so I can't really speak on him. But regardless, between Eriksen and Sissoko, I think Eriksen provides a better balance, better passing option continuously. I think Winks on the ball especially was really, really impressive. I think he had, like, you're mentioning his long balls, I think he had like 10 long balls, most of them accurate. Can't confirm right now, but I think that was it. So yeah, I think he had a good game. I think Most of the midfield had a good game, and I think it ended up being the ideal midfield to break down a team like PSV that ended up scoring in the first minute and then caving in for the remaining 90 or the remaining 88.
And yet, the way we got the winning goal was a result of, I don't know, Kieran Trippier being brought on to cross the ball, Davinson Sanchez being moved up front, Fernando Llorente coming on to pack out the box and make those layoffs. And as Nathan said, we kind of got a little desperate towards the end of the game, and Pochettino was quite interesting post-match. He'd taken off Lucas, and they were boozed for that substitution. And I think it's because people were enjoying Lucas's performance. He made nine dribbles in this game. He was beating players for fun, but there was very little in the way of end product from Lucas. He was kind of beating players in areas of the pitch where he perhaps, in my opinion, didn't need to be beating them. He could have made an earlier pass. And so I think that in some senses, Pochettino was justified in making that change. Others would argue that Son should have been the one to come off, but regardless, he made that change. Llorente comes on, makes it a great layoff for Kane's goal. Obviously, then he gives them something else to think about defensively from crosses also. And Pochettino made the comment that it was previously mentioned that he didn't have a plan B, and perhaps he showed that with this late change in style, that he does. He has another option, which is we go more direct, we put crosses in the box, we pack out the box with players that can head the ball. Nathan, you mentioned that you thought we got a little desperate, but do you think that was the right move to make at that point in the game?
Well, it definitely worked out, and I do support it. Yeah, you mentioned the term Plan B, and I feel that often when people sort of are talking of a Plan B, they're talking specifically about, you know, bringing Fernando Llorente on, putting Davinson Sanchez up top, and getting Trippier to cross the ball in. And I think that is overrated as a means of seeing a game out. And yet there are times for it, and this was clearly time for it. PSV, you know, for all of their skill, they're an Eredivisie side. They're a young side, although not young as most of that league. And that physically we had a huge upper hand on them, so it worked out. Pochettino, you know, knows the ability, knows the strengths that there are to Fernando Llorente, and understands the power of bringing on a target man. And he also knows when the correct time to utilise him is. And this was one of those times. And I think that he showcased that he knows how to use a plan B when the time is right. It's just not often the case.
And quite frankly, he's earned our trust, I think.
Absolutely.
I really did not enjoy people booing that change. That's not for me.
Well, sorry, just to jump in.
Sure.
What I always say whenever we discuss substitutions on this podcast is that the first, second and third reason that Poch ever takes a player off is because of fitness. So I imagine if Son had played more recently and Lucas had rested more recently, then Son would have come off. But his information and the information coming from the bench was that Lucas was the most fatigued player. So that's who he brought off. I imagine that was the reason.
I totally agree, and that's why I said to my friend Paul, who I was watching the game with, we had to assume that it's a fitness reason.
I think
that's fine.
Just adding on to that, a reminder that Lucas is by far the second most used player at Spurs this season, at least in the league, just behind Kane. You're not playing up top yet, mate. But yeah, so there's definitely a chance that there was some sort of fatigue there.
Sure. Okay, we're going to answer some questions. We had a whole manner of questions on a whole range of topics, but I'm going to start off with the most pertinent, which is, what brand of shampoo does Thiago use to keep that glorious mane silky fresh? And that was from, help me out with that at, guys.
Insonius Carvalho.
Okay. And for those that don't know, we mentioned Nuno Espirito Santo, or Thiago did, being changing his look. He's hirsute in one way. Thiago is hirsute in the opposite way, which is he has some follicles on him. Wow. And Thiago, we need to know more about your hair care routine.
Why is this a thing? I like the fact that we're focusing this all on me when there's another person on this three-man podcast that as long as well, at least another person, I actually do not know what Chris looks like, so Chris might as well have long hair too, I don't know. So yeah, I think I definitely have the distinctive look, I suppose. It's okay. I just use regular shampoo. I don't know what you want me to say. Nathan, do you have a specific hair product?
So I've had long hair for a decade now, and it's only since I dyed it blonde a couple of months ago that I've actually started to put any thought into what shampoo I'm using or what
You should have put thought into it before dying it blunt.
That, you know? That's good. Yeah, well done, mate. Yeah.
Okay, this has gone on longer than I intended, so I'm gonna move on to the next question from Mark Lynch. Mark, thank you for sending questions each week. You are very dedicated, and we really appreciate your support. He says, I remember Nathan's articles in the summer about replacing Dembele. Lamina and Seri were two of the options, I think. Both clubs seem to be struggling. How are they doing? I mean, I think he means the players. And does this change Nathan's mind as to future viability for us? So, obviously, Jean-Michel Seri is new to the Premier League, so there's a period of adaptation which is expected, and fair enough, you know, he won't settle straight away. Not only that, he's playing in a really badly organised Fulham team. Lamina is now in second season for Southampton. I would say he's been less prominent than Højbjerg this year so far. But Nathan, are you still big on Lamina and Seri?
I have watched very little Southampton this season, so I don't want to say too much about Lamina. I was certainly very excited about him for a little while, and that sort of maybe faded as his performances sort of didn't really continue quite as well as they were before. But I don't know, I'd have to go back and watch a bunch more Lamina now. Seri, I have been paying attention to. I wrote about Fulham for Stats Bomb. I feel like Seri sort of captures the general situation with Fulham this season, is that he's really good in possession, but his effort towards counter-pressing and the team's effort towards counter-pressing is really, really poor. And I looked at sort of his capacity for pressing and his efforts towards pressing in previous seasons with previous clubs, and generally I feel that he should be able to do more out of possession than he is doing currently. But I won't pretend that I haven't sort of taken a bit of a hit of confidence, and I'm not slightly worried about how well he would do for Spurs.
Thiago, are these players that have caught your eye previously from an analytics perspective?
Yeah, both of them. I mean, Jean-Michel Seri more, because he's just a more complete player than Lamina. But yeah, I also haven't caught much of Southampton this season, luckily enough. And everything I know about Fulham at the moment is kind of what I read from Nathan and other analytic writers that wrote the same thing. So I'm not quite sure how they're doing this season. I know that they're really good players, especially Seri. And Seri's a player that was great here, because he was playing mid-table here at Passos de Ferreira, which is a team that's in the second tier now. And he was awesome for them under Paulo Fonseca, which is the Shakhtar manager now. And Paulo Fonseca at the time, when he was coaching this mid-table small team, used to talk about Seri as the player to go big from that team. And just his quality on the ball was something else. His passing quality, his quality to take people on, just very agile. And he ended up being sold to Nice for like 1 or 2 million, something like that. And then the rest is what we know.
And in fairness to Lamina, he's still rating fairly well comparatively in terms of tackles and interceptions for a midfielder. So he's obviously doing some things right. He's well down on his dribbles from last year, is my understanding. So perhaps he's performing a slightly different role this season.
Yeah, he's also under Mark Hughes. So that's a judgment-free zone as far as I'm concerned.
I think Hughes is... he's not as bad as people think, but maybe that's a discussion for another time. Let's finish the pod with one more question for Thiago. And this is from Kostan J. Sheikh, who said, what are the main attributes you look for in youth players? And who are the standout performers in the Portuguese league this and last season? And are there any that could fit in at any of the top six sides in the Premier League? So basically, do Spurs' scouting for them. Tell them who Spurs should buy from the Portuguese league.
All right, so about youth players, I don't do much work with youth players beyond coaching. I don't do much scouting work on youth players, but if you're looking at youth players, even though that question is incredibly broad and not overly specific, as I would like it to be, I think you should, if you're looking at youth players, you should specifically look at technical and the mental attributes that you can see in a game, in terms of just like vision, match interpretation, all of that. And not necessarily the physical part, which is often more noticeable, and it's often what makes youth players stand out. But then, depending on what age group they're playing in will often take hit and won't carry over as well to whenever they get to the senior level. About players that are standouts in the league that could move to any top six in the Premier League. So top six in the Premier League is a very, very high standard. I think the last player to move from the Portuguese league directly to a top six in the Premier League was Lindelof. So that didn't go that well. And I don't want to misadvertise anything. And you need to, there's obviously players doing really well here, but you need to have in account just the level and their style of play and the fact, like, their age. Like, Jonas has scored about 1,000 goals for Benfica now, but he's 34. He's 34 and injury prone. You're obviously not going to get him for Tottenham, right? So, I mean, you've had citable names. Definitely Alex Telles, the Porto left back, who's just about basically 3PA creation numbers, but on the left and with the actual ability to beat a defender. And to run,
we'll have him. We'll have one of those, please.
So that's really good. I think he's arguably the best player in the league. He's incredible from set pieces and open play crosses and all of that. And he's quick and just a really strong left back. Guys like Bruno Fernandes have done well. Guys like Pizzi, but he's like 29 now. Hector Herrera, the center midfielder, Mexican center midfielder, has been connected to Spurs. He's 28, but he's a very solid all-arounder. He puts up really good defensive numbers. Even at Braga now, Ricardo Horta has done awesome things, and he has really good numbers. But it's rare from the top three to move directly to a top six in the Premier League. It's even rarer if it's not coming from one of those, right? But yeah, I think Ricardo Horta is really good. Nakajima, the Japanese player that's playing mid-table here and that's been recently connected to Leicester, I think that's just about his level, so not top six, but a little lower, but he's a really good player. So there's definitely talent here, but I'm not sure it's the ideal hunting ground for a top six Premier League team, necessarily. I think it's absolutely the ideal hunting ground for a team that's depending if you're looking at higher positions in our league or lower, for teams from lower Premier League sides or Championship sides, if you're looking at just English teams. So I think that the level gap might be a bit too big for most players, but there's always a couple that are massive standouts and that could do a job for sure.
That's great. I must admit, I stopped listening as soon as you mentioned Telles' abilities and what he could achieve on the left, and I was just daydreaming.
But he's on the left. You'd still have to deal with Trippier. You're aware of that, right?
You know, if we could replace one of Ben Davies or Kieran Trippier with a better player, I'd be happy right now. So yeah, ticks the box as far as I'm concerned.
I mean, if you could take him before he plays against Braga tomorrow, that'd be lovely. So make those connections quickly. Thank you.
Before we finish, we're going to bring back further reading, which we haven't done for a while, but this is the section of the podcast where we recommend articles or podcasts or anything football related that we've consumed recently. And we'll start off with Tiago. Is there anything that you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Oh no, I haven't read much lately.
Should we come back to you?
Yeah, let me think.
Nathan, how about you?
I also have failed to prepare a further reading bit, but Thiago's written a lot of good stuff over the years. Statsbomb, he's now writing for Goal Point, and also on his own Medium stuff, so I will have a look through some of his writing and pick out a particular piece.
That's cheating. That's such cheating. You know what? I'm going to... Can I give a shout out to anybody?
Yeah, of course.
So if you want to look at some really interesting analytic pieces... in English, obviously, I think Played Off the Park does some really good stuff that I particularly like to read. And I thought Nathan was going to go for him, but I caught him first. if you look up @_POTP, he's a fairly recent account that does some recruitment analysis and mostly recruitment with stats. And he's really good at it. And I really enjoy his pieces. So I'm going to give him a shout out because I think that was the last piece I read. If you want to go for something more tactically sounding, I'd say look into that Gunners pieces, even though he's a Arsenal fan. Yeah, I know. And he's kind of more of a Betis fan now, he turned. So
he's a very good writer.
He is. He's brilliant. So if you want to look into more tactical pieces, look into him at that Gunner. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's an Arsenal fan.
I think.
Yeah. Okay. So there's my shout out.
Thank you. And I will end with... I've been enjoying the Indie Football Podcast, which is occasionally hosted by Jack Pitbrook, who we've had on this podcast before, who I think is great. There was one episode in particular, which was after the last round of international matches, where they spoke about English fans and how they handle themselves abroad. And I felt it was a really important podcast, actually, and some of the things that Jack and Miguel were talking about were things that are often unsaid in media outlets. Jack subsequently wrote a piece which he got slated for by many kind of traditional English fans, but applauded by kind of more forward-thinking fans who don't want that culture to be a part of our reputation. It was a very brave piece to write. I really admired Jack for doing that, and I would recommend both the article and the podcast. That particular podcast episode was really great. Tiago, thank you so much for joining us and adding your expertise. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at TiagoESTV. I don't know why I shortened my last name like that, but I thought I'd made it more simple for English people, but I'm not sure it worked, but it's there. And yeah, I haven't written in English as much, but I promise I'll try if I get the time. And if not, at least I'll keep tweeting in English. So there's that.
Awesome. And there's a translate button anyway, so there's no excuse.
Yeah, I guess not.
And as ever, you can follow Nathan on Twitter at Nathan A. Clark. Thank you very much, Nath, as ever.
Cheers, mate.
I want to give a little apology to Bardi because he was meant to be on this podcast and I messed around with the dates and I apologise, Bardi. I'm sorry you weren't able to be here to join in. Although, quite frankly, you know, you've just brought it back to Italian football anyway, and we were talking about Portugal this week, so maybe it wasn't the time or place for you. If you want to email us, you can do at theextrainch@thefightingcock.co.uk, or you can find us on Twitter at @theextrainch. If you feel like leaving us a rating or review on iTunes or any other ratings app, that would be very much appreciated. Ratings are very helpful because they allow us it gives us weight when we're trying to attract sponsors, and sponsors are important because we'd like to be able to pay Nathan for his production work and also pay our guests who add so much to the podcast. So ratings would be very much appreciated. Hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and we'll be back soon with the next one.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.